Ladies, gentlemen, toons, do you like coffee? Have you been settling for mediocre coffee because it's what's most affordable or easiest to get your hands on or just simply all that's been available? Well, then I have good news because Sparkplug Coffee is here to elevate your mornings. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But what really makes Sparkplug special is that they deliver this great coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for our listeners. If you enter the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, all one word, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. The offer doesn't apply to any of the great gear they sell, but it applies to any size coffee order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? The time has never been better to raise your standards and start every morning with a great cup of freshly roasted coffee. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com. If only one of us could do a good Roger Rabbit impression.
I thought about doing that.
Please! I can't.
Coffee, please!
No.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Howdy, hey, motion picture misfits, and we thank you for imbibing some of that next 111 project juice. That was a mouthful. I wrote it, though. My own fault. Our original mission to record podcasts concerning the AFI's 100 Years, 100 Movies is far back in our rear view, so now we just cover anything. And we spoil everything. I'm the hard-drinking private dick who pals around with high-strung bunnies, Ryan Ellis, and this is the voluptuous lady who's into bestiality with said bunnies, my wife Jessica, I mean Bev.
That's me.
She's not drawn that way. The coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? How many times have Robert Zemeckis flicks been nominated for visual effects Oscars, and how many times have his films won the FX trophy? And also a bonus question, how many times have his mentor Steven Spielberg's films won Oscars? Is it more than Zemeckis films?
So I counted three wins. Three nominations, three wins. He didn't get nominated. Did he get nominated for Back to the Future?
Part two.
Oh, I missed that
but
one.
But you got the three wins.
This movie and Ghostbusters.
That's not
no, him. And Forrest Gump.
Yes.
My God, I'm like a drunk person. And Death Becomes Her.
Almost right in a row. Back to the Future 2 and 3 were in there. But Roger Rabbit, then those two. Then Death Becomes Her and Forrest Gump. So not only is it impressive to win multiple visual effects Oscars for your movies, but almost, well, 3 out of 5 anyway is pretty good. And one of those, like I say, Back to the Future Part 2 did get nominated.
But
what about the Spielberg question?
He was beat by Spielberg, who won for 4 films.
I saw 4 also, and I stopped. Was it only 4 in total?
I looked at all of the winners of SFX, and Spielberg had 4. This
Raiders, was 4. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, E.T., and Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
So it wasn't 5 or 6, okay. Once I saw 4, I just stopped because I knew that Spielberg won more. But only by 1, how about that? And Zemeckis' movies could have been nominated for a lot more when he got into the more recent era with that, what do you call it, the Uncanny Valley thing he did, which isn't really visual effects,
yeah,
it's
like
animation.
Polar Express or Christmas Carol, definitely guilty of that.
And that's animation, so I guess it doesn't really count. But Contact is a movie that no one thinks about, has a lot of great visual effects in it, a lot of stuff that's very subtle.
That's kind of his wheelhouse, he's really good at...
He's a master at this thing. Now before we get going, better warn you, as we often have to do about sound issues, the dogs are licking themselves in here. But bigger than that, our neighbors are out chatting. It's a Sunday evening. It's a beautiful day. Well, it's a little hot, but it's a pretty nice evening. So if you hear some random sounds in the background, it's probably that. All right, so Who Framed Roger Rabbit was released by Touchstone Pictures, which is Disney, effectively, just over 30 years ago on June 22nd, 1988. It was a blockbuster, and that's good because the project was very expensive. Bev, tell people what this movie is about with the skinny you wrote.
It's post-war Los Angeles, where cartoons and people coexist. They live together, work together, and even commit crimes against one another. That's why studio head R.K. Maroon hires Bob Hoskins' private dick Eddie Valiant to get to the bottom of what looks like a run-of-the-mill marital affair, but spins out into a vast conspiracy against one of the biggest stars of the toon world, Roger Rabbit.
Or, in a nutshell, forget it, Eddie. It's Toontown. And this is Chinatown with animation.
I think that there was a line in Roger Ebert's review that admired their restraint for not including that very line in the film.
I have no restraint at all, apparently. So the critical reception for this movie, 97% of critics liked it, 61 fresh, 2 rotten. and 84% of audiences. So a bit of a swing there, actually, 13%. And it's still sitting at 205th on Box Office Mojo's top 300 adjusted for inflation. It was second in 1988 to Rain Man at the box office, so the best picture winner was also the biggest hit, but this was right behind it. It's a sweet love story between a bombshell and a bunny, and they are truly in love with each other. It's pretty nice, actually, and of course the effects are really the whole reason to watch this movie. The performances by the humans are pretty good, especially Bob Hoskins, but you'll watch it for the animation. What'd you think of Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
I disagree that you just watch it for the animation. I think that it's a wonderful movie on top of the fact that it's technically masterful and really well done. I was pretty apprehensive about going back to this movie because I loved Roger Rabbit when it came out. I was 10 years old, and I watched it to death, and then I never watched it again until this week. But I am very happy to say that 10-year-old me knew a great movie when she saw it. Some of the technical stuff does actually look a little creaky now, particularly like classical animation compared to what we're accustomed to now. And we're so spoiled with computer-generated effects, but the script is solid, it's funny, it's super watchable. Roger Rabbit himself, the character, is still one of the most endearing, lovable characters of animation history.
So you thought it was funny, huh? I don't think I laughed out loud once. There's some decent jokes in it. Some pretty good jokes, actually, but it wasn't that hilarious.
I think it really had a good handle on the Tex Avery style.
Oh, yeah.
Sense of humor.
Very like, bawdy movie, too, for an animated film that's effectively for kids.
And the best humor in it is in the performances of the toons. In particular, Roger Rabbit. Everything he does is so extreme and over the top, just like an old Tex Avery cartoon. I was laughing out loud. I'm surprised that you weren't. I definitely was laughing out loud at lines that I forgot about. It's been so long.
More enjoyable and smile-inducing than laugh-out-loud inducing.
What is your impression of the film?
I still like it, but I wish I liked it more.
Oh, really? That's too bad.
I didn't dislike it by any means, but we've done quite a few movies from 1988. Rain Man, well, Big years ago, Die Hard years ago. What else did we do this year? We did more than just Rain Man. I can't think of all. Bull Durham and Last Temptation of Christ. So of all those, I would put it not even in the top five of that bunch I just mentioned.
I would. I'm a little surprised to hear that. I've always kind of wondered why this movie never stayed in the zeitgeist. I mean, probably because there wasn't all that much that followed it. It was a huge success when it came out, and they had a few additional shorts, and there was like a video game, but there were no sequels, and they never came back to Roger Rabbit as a character. So
too expensive and too difficult.
I guess so. Or they were just replaced with computer animation, which was the new thing, and nobody really wanted to go back to classical animation. Spent a lot of money on a movie that just wasn't going to be the fresh new thing. It's kind of drifted away from the cultural awareness, and I would say that somebody who's like 20 years old now would barely be aware of this movie.
Probably true. Zemeckis had 3 years between movies, which was rare for him back then. He was making one once every couple of years at least, but it was Back to the Future, then nothing until this, and then it was a whole string of them. It was Back to the Future Part 2 and 3 in 89 and 90.
They shot those at the same time, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. This movie was so long in post-production, which he wasn't necessarily directly involved with. Richard Williams is a name you find a lot online when you look up this movie. He was the animation supervisor, and he won a Special Achievement Oscar for the creation and direction of the cartoons. So it's not just his work, of course. It's other people, it's his technicians and his assistants and whatnot. They're doing the drawing as much as him. Although I heard he liked to draw Baby Herman. He liked that character and he kept it for himself. But computers were coming in, and what was it, 7 years later? Yes, with Toy Story. That changed everything. The game was changed completely by a Disney product, too. Toy Story is the same studio, effectively. Well, Pixar and Touchstone, but it's all Disney in the end. So why spend so much time, so many years, and so much money and so much of a hassle on flat 2D animation, as great as it looked and as well as it was integrated with Bob Hoskins, especially playing off these tunes? Not quite seamless, but pretty close. But why do all that when you don't have to anymore? We said the movie was a big success, and it's probably a bit surprising because the test screenings were not very good. They were done with older teenagers, though, and maybe isn't really the people to aim for. You should go older, people who recognize these cartoons from when they were young, or really young kids who can appreciate the goofy animation. And Robert Zemeckis said he wasn't changing a frame. So I guess he didn't, and look how it worked out. I guess he already had a lot of power, could say. No, I don't know if he had Final Cut at that point in his career, but then he had Spielberg behind him, because Spielberg was a producer on this movie. And it's set in 1947 L.A., well, effectively Hollywood. Here's another movie, and I love them all the time, or almost all the time at least, movie about movies. And movie making, one of the first things we see. Well, I guess they're making a TV short, but they're making something. No, it wouldn't be TV, because it's 47, of course. Cartoon reel you might have seen along with the news before you actually watch the movie. It's odd how adult the themes and details are for this kid's movie. Eddie drinks a lot. I already said hard drinking. He is constantly, especially in the early part of the film, drinking. There's no swearing, But there's some body stuff, especially baby Herman, too. At one point, doesn't he tweak a woman when he goes underneath? He puts his finger up as if he's going to poke it into her vagina?
He just lifts up her skirt to
check. I read somewhere, maybe they changed it since then, that he actually had a finger up as if he was going to poke it all the way up there. Maybe that's not in this version that we have.
Wow, that is pretty bawdy.
Or maybe they changed it in post-production and no one ever saw that. And there's also a pretty mature backstory between Eddie Valiant and his brother Teddy, who was squashed by a piano. Nice touch.
Drop the piano.
By the way, you mentioned R.K. Maroon is the studio head. A lot of people may not get that reference, but Bugs Bunny would call people usually.
What a maroon.
Exactly. I wrote that in one of my college scripts one time, and my friend Frank was the actor who had to say the line, and he didn't know what the hell I was talking about.
What?
I don't think anyone else did either.
Didn't everybody grow up watching Bugs Bunny cartoons, though?
I guess not. Well, the backstory with Teddy and Eddie is also about showbiz. They and their dad are involved in showbiz and stuff, along with Dolores, the Joanna Cassidy character. So this movie's all about showbiz all the way through.
So that's why he can sing and dance when he needs to at the end, to kill the weasels with laughter?
I think that's why that's there. We have that great tracking shot that show all the newspaper clippings and the stuff on the wall and the desk and everything, establishing Eddie's backstory. That was a wonder that they did, and they have it look like the night's passed and everything, and while the camera's doing all this roaming around, Hoskins gets in position for where he's supposed to be as he's passed out drunk on his desk, and they've changed the lighting so it looks like it's another day. One of the things about Zemeckis, too, you don't think about that kind of effect. Not really a visual effect, but a great touch.
In camera, yeah.
But okay, Roger's the main character, and he deserves hazard pay for what he goes through in that opening cartoon with Baby Herman.
I love the scene where he just keeps beating himself over the head with a pan, like, look, I can give you stars, look, wait!
Do you know who the actor is who's playing the director of the film, Raul J. Raul?
I do not.
Joel Silver, who was a producer in his own right on things like Predator, I think, and maybe even Die Hard. And apparently Michael Eisner, who was running Disney, when he saw that, didn't know it was Silver. He hated him for some reason. I didn't read exactly why. They had a big feud. And then when someone told him it was Joel Silver playing the character, he said, he was pretty good. So they didn't cut it out. And why would they? That's one thing about this film. It won the editing Oscar. And the interesting thing about that is that it really was more of a pre-edit type of movie than the usual post-edit. We think about JFK, for example, that won the editing Oscar with all the phenomenal cuts it has. This movie had to be set up in pre-production because you really couldn't cut out things unless you cut out the entire sequence because of the way the animation was with the cartoons.
And they would have had to have a pretty solid picture lock before they started any of the animation as well. Well, I'm sure that there were several takes and they had to go back and redo things here and there, but it's a tremendous waste of money to animate something that you don't need just to see if you want it. So, yeah, you would have to have your cut before you even started drawing.
And Artie Schmidt, Zemeckis' longtime guy, until Castaway, I don't think Schmidt died, I don't know why they don't work together anymore, but he won 2 Oscars in total, 1 for this movie, like I said, and also did cut Pirates of the Caribbean. Let's talk about editing right now since we're already on that touch. Did you like the editing in this film?
Yeah, I think it's paced really well. It moves really quickly. What is it, 90 minutes? It can't be that long.
About an hour and 45.
An hour and 45. It doesn't feel long at all. The ending always sneaks up on me where I'm like, oh, the movie's over already.
About half the movie takes place in the span of maybe one night because they're on a deadline.
And you have to give it credit, and I know a lot of this is in the script as well, but you have to give credit to a movie that's a film noir with a pretty complicated plot. That's very easy to follow. Of course, that's baked into the script because they want this film to appeal to kids. They want kids to be able to follow it. But they do a really great job of telling the story at a good pace so that you can just keep up with it and kind of follow the clues as Eddie follows the clues.
Right, and let's talk more about the animation, though, because that is really the selling point of the film. You say the story's great, and it is a good story. One of the great touches right off the bat, along with the opening cartoon with Roger and Baby Herman, is when you see Dumbo through the blinds. Such detailed animation work. Not only is he on screen, he's Dumbo there, but he's through the blinds, so you got to have it be through the slats and everything. It's just unbelievable that they could do that one thing back then. That probably took them days, weeks, months to do.
That's a good point. I never thought about that. They could have had a green screen back there, maybe.
I think I read somewhere that there's a swinging light in a scene just to make it even that much harder.
Oh,
because God, then animation's got to have a shadow that matches with the shadow that was in the scene with Hoskins.
Those are the touches that give it the real verisimilitude, is that the shadows match everything. Also, that camera doesn't make it easy by staying still. The camera is moving all over the place. The animators really had their work cut out for them. It's so easy to take it for granted now because we're spoiled with computer animation. Back when this film was made, this was absolutely the pinnacle of technology. All the planning they had to do and the coordinating, the blocking. They literally had like robots perform the actions of the two. His jacket is being pushed open by Jessica Rabbit, or when the weasels are walking around with the guns, they had either robots or they had marionette strings.
Right. The octopus that serves drinks as well.
If you watch it, trying to pay attention to all of the ways that the toons interact with the physical objects in the film, and you think about just how hard that would be, these people killed themselves to get the details right.
But I suppose the even more impressive feat than the technicals or anything else in the movie would be getting Disney and Warner's to have Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse on the screen at the same time, or the first time you see two major players in those two studios would be Daffy and Donald Duck in the nightclub before Jessica's number. That's a hell of a show they're putting on.
There has got to be a hell of a story about how they made this happen. There had to have been... Steven Spielberg and Michael Eisner must have been sitting in a room together working this all out. And this was also before Disney was the major powerhouse that it is now. Before Roger Rabbit came out, Disney was in the toilet. Disney Studios were doing really poorly. They had one bomb after another. People usually regard... What's it called? The Black Cauldron came out in like 87. Yep. It's like the worst film Disney ever made.
Rescuers Down Under wasn't all that successful.
Yeah, yeah.
Not by their standards, anyway.
After Walt Disney died, his son-in-law took over and kind of had this vision for the company, but it wasn't working out. The board forced him out, and he was replaced with Michael Eisner. So Michael Eisner was fairly new when this film got pitched.
He'd run Paramount before this, so he had experience running a studio at least.
Okay, but he was fairly new running Disney, and there could have been this part of him that just wasn't totally in the Disney culture yet.
Well, even though he didn't like him, and they may have both hated each other, Jeffrey Katzenberg was a big part of that. Katzenberg went on to work with Spielberg in the mid-90s on DreamWorks, but at this point, Katzenberg was a Disney guy too, a high-level executive, and from what I've ever known about that guy, very creative. So maybe Eisner was doing a great job, but he had one hell of a lieutenant.
Katzenberg is generally given credit for creatively creating the Disney Renaissance. And when I say the Disney Renaissance, I think most people know what I'm talking about. The Little Mermaid, the Beauty and the Beast, Mermaid, yeah. Lion King. Yeah, Aladdin. This is what followed. Aladdin, still considered one of Disney's greatest creative periods after perhaps Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
The late 30s, early 40s.
Yeah, when Walt Disney was first creating feature films. The studio was about to get really turned around, but the fact is, in the mid-80s, when they were pitching this film, maybe Eisner was just willing to take a risk on anything because there really wasn't that much to lose.
Yeah.
He kind of created the Disney culture, that hyper-loyalty, super litigious, and really protective of their brand. That was kind of created by Eisner, but maybe he just wasn't there yet. So this was this magical period when we could, for the one and only time in history, see Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny interacting on screen together.
But even at that, they had to have the same, maybe not number of lines, but they had to be equal in screen time. So every time they're on screen, they're on screen together.
Which is the same for Daffy and Donald, too.
Well, after Daffy and Donald do their great show, Jessica does hers, followed by the patty cake scene. And she may be animated, but they can make the pants a little tight. She may not be bad. She's just drawn that way. That's the famous line. But she's awfully sexy.
See, I always found her such an exaggeration femininity.
Pamela Anderson times 10.
What does her rib cage look like under all of that? Like, I'm baffled by the extremity of her, so much so that I don't really get what's so sexy about her. But you're certainly not the first heterosexual man to tell me that Jessica Rabbit absolutely does the trick for you.
Her boobs bounce up when they should bounce down. That's a strange touch they did on purpose. I guess it just gave it some kind of weird feeling.
You can say what you want about a rib cage, but the real defying the laws of physics is her dress. Has to be painted on, of course it is, because she is all painted, because there's no way a dress would actually stay up in the configuration that she has going on there.
Well, voiced by Kathleen Turner, who was in Zemeckis' Romancing the Stone a few years before that, and then she became Chandler's father on Friends. And Amy Irving, by the way, Spielberg's, I think, still wife at that point.
I'm pretty sure they were technically still married,
at least. But even if they weren't, he had her singing.
She was the singing voice of Jessica
Maybe he
Rabbit.
Didn't. Maybe Zemeckis picked her to sing.
Band. Neither of them were credited.
That's probably because strange. Of his voice, I guess. But then again, they do credit Charles Fleischer.
Yeah, yeah, who played Roger. Yeah.
Jessica's look is based on Rita Hayworth and Lauren Bacall with Veronica Lake's bangs. And then some imagination. I think my favorite gag in the whole movie, and the one I did laugh at, is when Eddie and Roger are in the handcuffs. And Roger goes to steady the box that Eddie's using to try to cut those handcuffs off, slipping his hand out. You could have done that any time. Not any time. Only when it was funny.
Even though his life depended on not getting caught by the weasels earlier.
Because Roger lives to perform. The only thing he loves more than performing is Jessica. And it might be close there, too. He might even love performing more than her.
Do you agree with me that he is that charming and lovable of a character? That he is really one of the great animated characters? Watching the movie again, I was struck by just how endearing I found him. I forgot about how much he really is the heart and soul of the film.
Even when he does something stupid like the shave and a haircut, he cannot resist coming out with shave and a haircut, blasting through the wall. Two bits!
And if he had failed to be charming and funny, nothing about this film would have worked. But he's such a great character. He's pure pathos, and those gigantic eyes, and his amplified earnestness to entertain everybody and make them laugh. So Charles Fleischer, who voiced him, He insisted that he would be on set and he would help the other actors by, like, actually performing across from them behind the camera. And he went as far as to insist on wearing a rabbit suit on set.
There's a video of that in the special features section. You can see him dressed like that.
I don't know if that helps your co-stars or not.
Well, if you have a great hero in Roger, and for that matter, Eddie, then you gotta have a great villain in Judge Doom. Christopher Lloyd plays him. He, of course, was in all the Back to the Future films, so Zemeckis knew him well. The dip that he uses was a mixture of three paint thinners, which is harmless to humans. That's why Eddie can touch it just fine. But it kills the Toons. Another very dark touch. He's killing the characters. They're not human, but they're dying.
Can we talk about how upsetting the scene is when he wants to demonstrate the dip and he kills the shoe? That shoe didn't do anything wrong. I get that you're a judge, jury, and executioner, but the shoe was just walking right. He just got out of his box. Okay, when I was a kid, I found that scene totally traumatizing. But more traumatizing than the shoe getting dipped is the idea that that shoe had a mate that will forever be lonely because his mate was murdered.
Maybe little shoes back home
to take care of. Isn't that the most heartbreaking thing? They couldn't have gone a little easy on us. They couldn't have melted a piece of furniture or something. They had to watch that shoe shaking and looking with his big eyes. It still breaks my heart.
And of course, Judge Doom ends up being a cartoon himself. Kind of scary the way that he's drawn and voiced. It's not so much as Lloyd, maybe. I don't know if Lloyd was doing the high-pitched part of the character. When he dies, it's like the witch in Wizard of Oz. He even says, "I'm melting."
Tim Curry got cast, but somewhere during the audition process, they all determined that he was actually too scary.
Like I read, Steven Spielberg especially thought that.
Yeah, and then they cast Christopher Lloyd instead, who was still pretty scary. He apparently tried his hardest not to blink. Obviously not when he's wearing those great glasses that had the hard reflection, so it just looked like his eyes were blanked out altogether. When we think he's died, when it's like the fake out and he gets run over by the steamroller. Mm-hmm. Is that what it's called? Steamroller?
Sure, why not?
Sure. You know what I'm talking about, the cement roller thing. Such a cartoon way to die, but not die, to get run over by a steamroller. But I have a little trivia for you. What is the other 1988 film where the villain
Fish
gets...
Called Wanda.
Oh, you're so good! You're so good!
I read that too.
I didn't even read that. I just remembered it with my own magical brain.
Kevin Kline, who won the Supporting Actor Oscar in 1988.
It was like a big year for steamrollers. Yeah. For the audience, in case you don't remember, the villains of both films get run over by a steamroller, but don't die.
Right.
Because he gets sunk into the concrete. It's still wet in A Fish Called Wanda.
Kevin Kline, yeah.
Yeah.
Christopher Lee, Sting, John Cleese wanted the role. All of them were in talks in one way or another, or at least were maybe going to play Judge Doom before they went with Lloyd, who's a likable guy in real life, really likable, but does play good villains. This one and Star Trek III come to mind right off the top of my head.
He said it was some of the most fun he ever had on set, one of his favorite characters he ever played.
Okay. You also have his underlings, the hyenas, who laugh themselves to death. Well, comics do love it when they kill, or when they die in this case.
I love that it's the hyena cousins, like the weasels. He has the line, "You're going to laugh yourselves to death just like your idiot hyena cousins." Mm. Maybe that leads into the hyenas in Lion King. Because I feel like the Lion King hyenas actually remind me a lot of, what are they called, the Toon Squad or the...
Okay, sure.
Instead of the Goon Squad. Anyways, the weasels. They remind me so much of the hyenas. The one really crazy hyena in Lion King who has the googly eyes and is always laughing.
I said hyenas. I guess they're weasels, aren't they?
Well, but there's a line in the film. You're going to laugh yourself to death just like your idiot hyena cousin.
Identifying them wrong, though, aren't I?
Yeah, they're weasels. Yeah. Oh, I thought that's what you were referring to.
I was just thinking laughing hyenas. Judge Doom and the weasels are trying to protect the Cloverleaf deal. That was maybe going to, well, was going to be the name of the third Chinatown movie. They never did a third Chinatown movie. There was, of course, Chinatown in 1974. The Two Jakes that Nicholson directed and acted in, of course, in 1990. Never did another one of those movies. Robert Town, who wrote, I guess, both of the first two, definitely wrote the first Chinatown, wanted to do Cloverleaf about the transportation system. Because I believe Two Jakes is about oil, and the first movie, of course, is about water. Eddie has a line when he hitches a ride on a streetcar that they've got the best public transportation system in the world. But which, they're a car culture now.
Oh, yeah, L.A. residents would laugh at a line like that. And it's true that they did have a decent public transportation system and that tire companies and car companies teamed up against it and bought them out of business so that they could sell more cars. That was not made up for Roger Rabbit. And the freeway in L.A. is right where the public transportation train used to run.
So this story was what Town wanted to do with the movie he was going to do, Cloverleaf.
Which and it's been... what happened in reality.
Yeah, right.
Well, except without cartoons.
Well, this movie would have been just human beings.
Yeah, way more boring.
As far as the cartoons again, we do see Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, who didn't exist in 1947. There's other characters you see that didn't exist then, either I was reading. But Spielberg wanted them in, so they were in. Chuck Jones was involved in this movie, so the guy who worked with Warner Brothers for so long, but disavowed the film. He wanted the Toons to be the focus. I guess that was his problem. I wouldn't be surprised, and you'll never know this for sure, if it was about money. And then he said, well, this is why I'm really mad.
I agree. That's a stupid reason.
But that was his problem, because Eddie, in the end, is the main character. We've been talking more about Roger and Jessica so far, but a great performance as well by Bob Hoskins. But the story really is more about the Toons in general. I guess overall, they have as much screen time as any human, if you add them all up. But Jones didn't think so.
Eddie's like the straight man. He's obviously the lead character. But one of the great things about his performance is that he plays it 100% straight. Yeah. All the actors treat the Toons like they've always been there, which creates such a great world.
In their world, they were always there.
So it feels that much more authentic. And he's just a great straight man. He has a story for how he hates Toons because they killed his brother and never wants to go to Toontown. But he has this relationship because he used to be the detective for the Toons. They used to spend a ton of time
like
in Toontown.
Like Nicholson in Chinatown.
And he's the driver of the mystery. And his reluctance, of course, adds plenty of convenient conflict whenever they needed to spice up a scene. But I just love that he plays it completely straight. There is a legit normal grown-up mystery in this film, and the Toons keep spicing it up and making it funny.
A lot of pathos too, because of his brother being dead, and he's not involved in showbiz anymore, even though he had been when he was young. So he's not even doing what he always did when he was young. It's not really his passion to be a private eye. By the way, for those who don't know, Bob Hoskins is English. I think there's one line he says where you can think, okay, maybe the accent's sneaking through a little bit, but otherwise, it's flawless. He's got a great American accent. He was in Mona Lisa a few years before this, and he was a bad guy, a real tough dude. Maybe not the villain, but a bad, tough guy kind of thing. So that's why I thought he could play this hard-bitten character. He's been in a ton of movies, but not a whole lot of major roles other than this one. Eddie Murphy and Bill Murray were two people that were talked about. There are many more options than that, but those two stand out the most. Murphy's a good actor, but he's more of a cartoon himself in a way. Bill Murray, I was reading, regrets not getting this role.
Apparently it's one of the roles that he missed out on because he famously refuses to have an agent.
Yeah, he's missed out on roles before because of that.
It would have been a different movie with him in the lead.
Closer than if it had been Murphy, though. Bill Murray makes more sense.
Yeah, has Murphy ever really played straight like that? Has he ever
good
been
question.
The
Dream
straight
Girls.
Man?
But he's not playing off comedic characters, though.
He's playing a character. Mm. Yeah.
Hoskins went a little loopy, especially when acting in front of a green screen, and that's mostly in Toontown. Because when he's on screen, generally, there's real people, real objects, cars and buildings and things, and the cartoons, of course, are added in post-production. But when he goes to Toontown, he's surrounded by nothing. But I guess he got through it well enough.
Well, no actor can get away with not working with green screen now. Yeah, mocap is probably like 20% of Hollywood now.
And green screen's in so many movies, or blue screen sometimes, that have nothing to do with visual effects that you think of anyway. It's subtle and great in a lot of movies. Eddie hates Toons like the men hate kids in recent podcasts that we've done, or at least that I've been involved in. Jurassic Park with Alan Grant, and when Chris and I did The Mighty Ducks, where Gordon Bombay hates kids at first. So Eddie's like that with the Toons.
I mean, a plot line like that, or I should say a characteristic like that, screenwriters put this stuff into movies just because it adds convenient conflict.
As far as the bad guy, Judge Doom, there's subtle clues that he is a self-hating Toon. He avoids the dip when it gets spilled. He makes sure not to get anywhere near it. His teeth, his gloves, his cape are disguising what's really underneath. I don't remember if I picked... I don't think I did realize that he's supposed to be a cartoon. I was even reading that his cape blows when they're inside, and that's a cartoon-type effect. Why would his cape move when they're just inside? No one else's clothes are moving. Joanna Cassidy was Dolores. She was in Blade Runner, did a lot of TV. Doesn't have much to do in this movie. She's kind of wasted, really. It's sort of a Hollywood cliche where the woman doesn't... Jessica has certainly more to do than Dolores does.
Dolores is the reactress. She's there because Eddie has to be tough, and she has to remind the audience that there are stakes and somebody cares if he wins or he loses. But let me say this. It is pretty ironic that Eddie is constantly expressing so much surprise that Jessica Rabbit would deign to be with Roger when he himself is dating a woman this far out of his league. She could be on another planet. Are you kidding me? It's like, no, she's over 40. Nobody would ever love her. There's nothing wrong with Bob Hoskins.
He's not a handsome man.
But he's not a 10. She is, aside from her age, a total babe. She's a total babe, period. No matter what her age is. It's a ridiculous idea that they'd be together, because he's also a loser, let's not forget. Mm-hmm. And a drunk. Although the movie implies that they were together before all of his problems happened. So, yes, okay, she just loves him from before. Although, all these years and he's never made an honest woman out of her? What is she doing with this guy? So, all I'm saying is, Eddie, get off your high horse about how you think that Jessica can do better than Roger.
A lot of the people who voiced these cartoon characters in their heyday voiced them here, too. Mae Questel, or Kestel, however you say her name. She is Betty Boop. And others did the voices as well. The last human actor I want to mention is Stubby Kay, who plays Marvin Acme. This was his final film, and he, of course, dies in the movie, the character does. He'd been in Guys and Dolls, and he's a pretty memorable part of Cat Ballou. Robert Zemeckis has made 18 movies in 40 years, so pretty much one every couple of years, but he did have that big stretch between Back to the Future and this. We mentioned Forrest Gump and the Back to the Future series and all those animated films he made for about 10 years. Some of them are good, some of them are not so good. But it is nice to see him back to using real human beings on screen again, like Flight, where he had Denzel Washington, who got an Oscar nomination. And I'm sure there's a lot of visual effects in that, so Zemeckis can still show off his talent for that kind of stuff, but still have human beings on screen. And then The Walk, which I saw and liked just fine. I didn't see it on the big screen or on IMAX or any of that kind of thing. Probably would have been so freaky to see that movie on a huge screen.
I'm too afraid of heights to ever watch that movie.
The documentary Man on Wire is the same story, but then they did The Walk a few years later on. I also think that despite Zemeckis' talent with visual effects, he's underrated with characters and story, especially in the Back to the Future movies, because I've mentioned before, Back to the Future Part 1, really the whole series, but if you just had to name one movie, is one of my all-time favorite films. I don't know where it would rank, but it's got to be in the top 10. Partly because, well, maybe largely because the story and the characters are outstanding.
You don't have this many enduring classics just because your special effects were good. Because especially in Roger Rabbit, they do look dated now. These movies are classics because the story is amazing, the characters are amazing, because of all the little touches. When you pay that much attention to detail of the effects, yeah, he also pays that much attention to detail to what the characters are wearing or the casting process. I think he's really an excellent casting guy. Now, he's gotten lucky that he's gotten some of the best and most charismatic actors in the business, and maybe that's his secret, that he really casts for charisma. I think also of Castaway, there's not really all that many effects in that movie at all, but he casts the most lovable actor in Hollywood to just do his thing for like an hour straight.
And that movie holds up even now.
The middle of the movie is by far the best part of the movie, but that hour is a masterpiece right there. When he's on the island, it's absolutely incredible filmmaking. And so many of his films are still so watchable. I agree. To call him just a great special effects director is really selling him short on what he truly is, which is an amazing storyteller.
And Jodie Foster in Contact, that's one of her best performances ever. And she's given a lot of great performances.
I always remember that moment. She's in the little capsule thing. What is the line she says over and over? Like, I'm good to go. I'm good to go. Oh, it gives me chills, her performance in that moment.
The writers in this film are Jeffrey Price and Peter Seaman. They're partners, so they've written a lot of scripts together, including The Grinch from 2000, the Jim Carrey one, and Shrek 3. They based it on Gary Wolf's 1981 novel, Who Censored Roger Rabbit. The producers, Frank Marshall and Robert Watts, and then a lot of executives, including Spielberg, Kathleen Kennedy, and Steve Starkey, who worked a lot with Zemeckis all through this early part of his career. The movie's 185:1. We watched the DVD, which I thought was going to look like crap, but I thought it looked just fine, actually. Well, I didn't think it would look like crap, but I didn't think it would look as good as it does.
I remember, like, the first 5 minutes of the film, I was thinking, oh, boy, this animation, it looks so creaky now compared to what we're accustomed to. But after 5 minutes, I completely forgot it because...
But the actual DVD print, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the print looks great.
Cinematographer Dean Cundey, we talked about him not that long ago, Jurassic Park, also shot Back to the Future, Apollo 13. What a resume. The composer, Alan Silvestri, with a score I'm sure you didn't love, but he did Back to the Future, great score, Forrest Gump, several of the Avengers films, and this one, in Roger Rabbit, is very Back to the Future-esque, I thought.
And a film like this, it's appropriate to treat it with a really over-the-top score. I mean, when you're going for that Warner Brother cartoon, the Looney Tunes, of course it's going to be heavily scored and really cutesy, and you mark every beat with a little musical accompaniment. I didn't mind the score at all.
Spielberg didn't want him on Back to the Future, and then he heard what Sylvester had done and said, no, he's in, and he's done a lot of great things since. So the influence, of course, we mentioned Chinatown. This was also compared to Howard the Duck by some, and not in a good way, but before it was released. Like we said, the test screening did not go well. The other influence I have is it wasn't merchandised the way that Disney usually merchandises things. How could Disney fail at that? There were not that many toys, Roger and Eddie and Jessica and all that kind of thing. Hard to believe. You think they would have so much of that. But then there's that line in Toy Story 2 about how short-sighted marketers did not meet the demand, something like that, about Toy Story toys as well. Also Disney.
I don't know if Disney was really doing it at this time. Because like you said, Black Cauldron, Rescuers Down Under, and then the film that immediately followed Roger Rabbit was Oliver and Company. These films were not heavily marketed. They didn't have a lot of toys to accompany them.
That may be true, but it just seems shocking to me that Disney wouldn't have marketed anything, because it seems like an automatic, obvious thing, but especially a movie like this, that they already put so much money into to begin with.
I think it's just because we think of Disney as that kind of company now.
And they weren't then.
Yeah.
All right, the awards in this section is quite a bit here. You got 3 Oscars for editing, the visual effects, no surprise in that count, and sound effects. It was nominated for the cinematography, the sets, and the sound. Williams won that Special Achievement Oscar. The movie was also put in the National Film Registry in 2016, along with Blackboard Jungle, which we covered, The Lion King, which we covered, The Princess Bride, we covered, and Thelma Louise, that we covered. But I didn't see any AFI films in that year, just those ones that we've since covered on the next 100 project. And Who Framed Roger Rabbit was nominated for the Top 100 Laughs, which I don't think I really agree with, but okay, fine, it's cute and fun. The Top 100 Genres in the Fantasy category, that makes sense. And the Top 100 Quotes with, "I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way," by Jessica. Would have been a pretty good quote to put on the list. I wouldn't have put it on there, but it's a good quote.
And just one more achievement. Roger Rabbit, along with Oliver and Company, really helped save Disney. It just really helped them get back on their feet and start making money again.
The Little Mermaid. Such a success. Little Mermaid deserves more credit than that.
Okay, but this film was tremendously successful. This was the beginning of them turning the ship around. You can't deny that Roger Rabbit was probably the most successful film that they had had at that point in years.
So your last thoughts on Who Framed Roger Rabbit, our final movie of June?
Well, it seems like you and I might disagree on this, but I think it holds up as a classic, and I'm disappointed that it's not still in the cultural zeitgeist.
You mentioned this movie on Jurassic Park. For that reason alone, you thought maybe this movie would age better than Jurassic Park has, and for most people, that's not true.
I think they've both aged exceptionally well, but it's just that Roger Rabbit happens to hold more of a place in my heart for nostalgia. It's also the type of movie I'm going to like a lot more than the type of movie that Jurassic Park is, just because that's my taste.
And the fun ending with all the cartoon characters on screen at the same time. That must have taken them forever to draw.
Oh, dude.
It's a very enjoyable film, and you have to admire Hoskins' commitment to working with things that aren't even there. Exhibit A for actors who complain about working in front of a green screen. Use your imagination, which Hoskins obviously did. He may have gone a little loopy, but he still made it look like he's working with these things that aren't even there yet. They're going to be drawn months later.
You're an actor. You make believe for a living.
If you're ever on stage, you should be able to do that kind of thing in this case, too. And Roger and Jessica are very cute foils for him. It's a solid thumbs up, but it's been surpassed technically, and it's not even for me in Robert Zemeckis' top five. But an enjoyable movie, and a good one. 30 years old. All right, we're off next week to enjoy Canada Day, although a Scoring at the Movies episode will be going up on July 5th, our third one, and that'll be The Karate Kid. But when the next 112 project leaps from our computers to your audio canals on July 9th, we'll have a chat about the mega hit that set up the MCU juggernaut, Iron Man! Anyway, you know the song. So the coming attractions trivia for Iron Man, which is 10 years old. There are at least three comic book movies that end with the main character saying his own name as the last line of the movie. Name those three, or more if I've forgotten some, and there are more. You already have one.
So for the answer to that question, check out our next podcast about Iron Man. And if you crave more Ryan and Bev between now and then, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, and while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered over 250 movies now, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, but while you're there, in return, perhaps you could give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51, or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT, that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case sensitive.
This is the last line in the movie, but I'm going to steal it anyway. Buddy, 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 that's all, folks.
And cut.
Happy Canada Day and July 4th.